just letting you know.
It's great.
Yeah.
That's really great.
Okay, well, I think that this is a good chance to begin. Good evening, everybody. I'm Lori Rojas. I am a student here at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. I'm also an organizer for Platypus in the city of Chicago and an editor of the Platypus Review. Thank you for coming tonight for Left Behind, the working class in the crisis. I'm very happy to have you all here. I just want to give a brief introduction to Platypus. Platypus began as a reading group here in SAIC. We started reading a correspondence between Adorno and Marcuse on the 1960s New Left. From there, we ended up moving into broader fields about questions about the New Left and realized that there were a lot of unresolved issues from the Old Left. When we concluded a lot of the readings at the end of 2006, we basically decided that we wanted to investigate more the history of the Left. And we founded an organization in December of 2006. Right now, we organize reading groups and film screenings at SAIC here, at Loyola, University of Chicago, MIT, and New York. We have also organized public fora, like tonight's one that we called What is Imperialism, another one called The Three R's, and the question of reform, revolution, or resistance. And we've also organized events around Israel and Palestine. We also organize research and journalism through the Platypus Review. And basically, all of our efforts are focused on this problems and tasks inherited from the quote-unquote old left, 1920s to 1930s, new left, 1960s, 1970s, and post-political left, 1980s to 1990s, for possibilities available today. Our approach to the history of the left can be characterized by this idea by Walter Benjamin of going against the grain, reading history against the grain. Platypus believes that past movements in history of the left have offered potentials that have gone unrealized, but nonetheless continue to task us today. Platypus contends that a fundamental transformation of existing society is not only possible, but necessary. Tonight's events is motivated by the May Day Immigrants' Rights going on next Thursday, on May 1st. Any students interested in participating in May Day, come talk to me or come talk to anybody else in Platypus that you No, but I'm always available. We'll be meeting at SAIC in the 112 South Michigan Avenue building at 10 a.m. And from there, we'll go together to the rally. So tonight's event, is basically put together in light of recent economic and political change. Platypus wanted to host an event, moderated panel discussion with Q&A that would address these issues of trade unions, workers' rights, international labor solidarity, immigration, and global capital. The format for tonight's event will have our panelists will introduce themselves and the groups they're representing by giving an account of a recent action or event that they have organized or participating in that best represents a response to the current economic and political crisis. Additionally, the panelists will have been asked by Platypus to address issues of the relationship between labor organizations and political struggles and their estimation of the Employee Free Choice Act. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our panelists. On my left, we have Abraham Mara. He's an organizer with UE, United Electric, and participated in the Republic Windows and Doors Factory sit-in. After him, Chuck Hendricks is an organizer for Unite Here, here in Chicago. Aaron Hughes, after that, is currently or recently a representative at the International Labor Conference in Erbil, Iraq, and is also a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And finally, James Thindua is the executive director of Chicago Jobs with Justice. And I will give the table with to Abraham.
Hi, my name is Abraham Mora. I'm with the UE, United Electrical Workers here in Chicago. As a good ally to the women in the audience, I have to point out that I'm happy to be on another labor panel that is all men, But, you know, sorry. I wasn't sure if everyone would get it, but I knew James was going to be here, so I would be safe saying something about, you know, pointing out that we're all men, but that's okay. how many, so the question is, like, is to talk about an action, a recent action that kind of exemplifies my organization's reaction to the current economic and political crisis. So how many folks have heard of the Republic Windows and Doors occupation? Apparently, one of my fellow organizers asked a room full of folks that a few weeks ago, and nobody raised their hands. So I just wanted to make sure. There is a test, then, since majority of folks have heard of it. So, one, why did we pick Bank of America? Yes. I mean, we essentially made a strategic decision, right, an organizing decision. The bank was the one who could actually give people, you know, give the workers what they were owed. The company wasn't able to do it anymore. The company had been, you know, playing a kind of dodgy game of hide and seek for weeks before that, and were out of money. They didn't have any money. They'd been moving stuff to Iowa for a month before that, probably. The bank was the only one who could actually do it. how many people know how long that local had been part of the UE? Ah, cheat. Yes, let's hear it. The guy who works in the UE hall. How long? 3 years? It was 5 years. 5 years, a couple more years. But yeah, really short amount of time. That local had been, you know, had struggled the whole time that they had been a local in the UE, a story a lot of folks are familiar with. But I think, again, kind of very directly answers that question about what we're doing. You know, there was more to that action than just the occupation. It was that 5 years of organizing. It was that 5 years of struggle beforehand. Is someone keeping time?
I am.
Okay, sorry. I mean, that local had come into the UE out of a mobbed-up union that was a company union, essentially, and it was a fight from the very beginning. Right before they organized with the UE, they had been in a failed strike because their union had refused to support their strike. They struck against that company for a few weeks. And failed and had to go back in because the union essentially made a deal with the bosses. So the folks went back in, lost that strike, continued, you know, in those really, really poor conditions that they were in, and then ended up seeking help from the community, talked to a worker center here in Chicago, and then later talked to us and organized into the UE. That's the work we've been doing. In this economic crisis, is really figuring out who the worst of the worst are in the economy right now. We've been we've been slowly reaching out to warehouse workers who've kind of been very directly impacted by the economic crisis because their jobs are tied in many ways to retail. We're traditionally a manufacturing union, but a lot of manufacturing jobs have gone overseas, and so the kind of the next in line in terms of being closest to the point of production are a lot of the distribution workers who handle the goods that come in from overseas. Well, they're facing massive layoffs, right? Because their jobs are so tied to retail, and so whereas in like Republic, it was 100 workers, maybe a year, in layoffs before they finally closed. These workers are facing, you know, similar sized shops are facing, you know, that many layoffs in a matter of months, and just has just been a massive turnover. And so we as a union have just felt like we need to go out there and build power among those folks who are again the closest to the point of production, who happen to be these warehouse workers now, kind of because of the way our economy has now, you know, restructured itself into kind of a pull economy, so that the retailers are pulling goods rather than manufacturers pushing goods through the economy. I think the obvious answer was, of course, that the action was the occupation, but then there's a deeper answer there, which is, you know, we're organizing, we're actively out there organizing workers. Thanks.
Chuck Hendricks.
My name is Chuck Hendricks. I'm an organizer with the union Unite Here, Local 1 in Chicago. Anyone know about the Congress Hotel strike? Okay, people know the Congress strike. I would hope anybody that lives in the city after 6 years would know about it. We're a union of about 450,000 hotel workers, casino workers, food service workers, and laundry workers around North America. My specific focus in Chicago is with the food service industry. So I was thinking about what exemplifies what my union does. We've been talking about it, the economy a lot in meetings that I've been in. And I guess I understand that I hear on the news every day that the economy is bad, and I see those foreclosures. I think that the working class is always in a state of crisis. Because we never are going to get anything more than we can take from the capitalist. So I guess I don't see why we would do much differently than what we should be doing anyways. To that extent, we haven't drastically changed what we're doing as a union. Our main focus has been, how do we grow power and grow numbers and grow density in our industries, not reaching out and trying to like organize other industries, but sticking to our core industries, the hospitality sector of the economy. Even in this really hard time, people will go to restaurants a lot less frequently right now than they would otherwise go. They'll stay at hotels a lot less than they would otherwise. However, in a good economy, a boss will say, "What are you crazy? I can't give you a dollar raise." In a bad economy, a boss is going to say, "What are you crazy? I can't give you a dollar raise." It all comes down to the question of power. That's it. And if we can squeeze it out of them, we will. So I was looking for an example of how we respond to fighting the boss. And a good example would be, anybody ever heard of the company Aramark? Okay. Oh, hi guys. So Aramark's a large food service company in the country with over 100,000 employees, of which about, 25 to 30% are union members, spread out at literally 10 to 15,000 locations. An Aramark shop would probably be 10 workers to maybe 100 workers at the most. And if the goal is to build real power, it can't be we're going to organize 15 workers or 10 workers or 20 workers at a time, but we have to figure out how to organize whole swaths of people to have real density in that company and be able to control the shop floor at 10, 15,000 locations all at the same time. To that extent, we picked a fight with Aramark maybe about 2 years ago, and with the vision that that fight would last a long period of time, that we would have to cost the company a lot of money and put up lots of fights and organize lots of workers and lots of communities against Aramark until they did the right thing. Which is to recognize the workers' right to a union and the workers' right to a fair contract. What that meant was building political pressure, community pressure, and worker pressure on the company all at the same time. Political pressure means figuring out how to use the leverage you have with politicians, whether they're shitty politicians, like some of the people in Chicago, good politicians like the, relatively good politicians like the mayor of Los Angeles, and wherever you can to figure out how to do that. So an example would be, in Florida, we figured out that they had the entire prison system, which is $50, $60 million worth of business each year, how to pressure the politicians in that state, based on what they cared about, which was the cost of the food, to dump Aramark. Well, you cost the company $50, $60 million in a day. By by kicking them out of all the prisons, you get their attention. And that played itself out over and over again, the DuPage prison system in Illinois, the New Haven public school system in Connecticut, and over and over and over again around the country of figuring out how to leverage the company by costing them money. At the same time, using community allies and community people that support unions and support the labor movement and support workers to pressure companies that they also use, like universities that have social justice missions, to tell their clients, right? A school like DePaul has it as their mission to support people and immigrants and all sorts of stuff, which they don't really mean. But it's a question of, can you pressure them to actually have to face that? And through community allies such as Jobs with Justice, one of our allies, the clergy, professors, putting enough pressure on these organizations that they also have to make a choice about what to tell Aramark to do. And then lastly, but really importantly, is organizing the workers to do it. So it's not just these outside groups, but workers. To that effect, in 2008, Aramark contracts were up at lots of different shops around the country, and those workers did actions not just for themselves, but to say, workers around the country need the right to join a union. In New York, I believe three banks, the workers, the cafeteria workers in those banks, went on strike for 3 to 4 months, fighting for their own contract, but also being the public face of this fight against Aramark. In Chicago, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, all around the country, there were Aramark rallies to put pressure on their clients, to put pressures on politicians, and it showed that Aramark workers all around the country were sticking together. Because one of the biggest things that my union believes in is picking big, big, big nationwide strategic fights and figuring out how to take on a whole industry at a time. And Aramark really is its own industry. It's, you know, 100,000 people. After about a year-long fight and having many shops on strike and costing them hundreds of millions of dollars in business, and many of our community allies doing actions, delegations, even civil disobedience, Aramark caved. And workers around the country won a really great victory where thousands and thousands and thousands of them got to join the union and win good contracts, as well as people that currently had the union winning contracts and winning things like free health insurance. That's an example of who we are.
You got a minute.
That's who we are. We're a union that likes to pick big fights with rich companies and fuck them.
Okay. Aaron, go ahead.
My name's Aaron Hughes, and I just want to start off by saying it's pretty humbling to be on a panel with Chuck and Abraham and James here. I'm not a worker myself. I'm not a labor organizer. I'm a veteran. I'm part of an organization called Iraq Veterans Against the War. It's a national organization with 56 chapters across the United States, some in Europe, and some that are actually in Iraq and Afghanistan right now. Humbling. Humbling is about all I can say of my experiencing returning to Iraq after being out of the country for 4 years to participate in the first international labor conference in Erbil, Iraq, thanks to U.S. Labor Against the War. They had been organizing for over a year to put this conference together with the different constituencies in Iraq to bring as many labor constituencies in the country together. Currently, since the invasion, we've helped Iraq establish a new constitution that provides for workers' rights. However, Mr. Bremer and the occupation forces and the new government carried over Saddam's laws in regards to organizing and workers' rights, so they have absolutely no rights. And in 2006, in fact, they froze all their funds and they took their assets. Yet, despite all this, these workers are still organizing, and they're winning. The oil workers in the South, a federation of over 25,000 workers, one of the strongest union in Iraq, went on a massive strike, massive demonstration to kick the British military and KBR, Halliburton's subsidiary, out of their area and out of their oil fields. The electrical workers in the central part of the country, another large labor federation that they're coming out of, when the U.S. military took over their power plant, and they told the workers, you can't bring the supplies onto this power plant. The workers said, well, we need the supplies to maintain our power plant. The military says, it doesn't matter, it's a security threat. The workers go on a massive strike, go on a demonstration. They get calls from the central government telling them to stop because they're pissing off the U.S. government and they're pissing off the American soldiers. It doesn't matter, they keep fighting. You wanna know why? Because they're fighting for their communities, because they've seen how many other power plants have been shut down and blown up over the last 6 years of this occupation. And they kept fighting, and they won, and the U.S. military left that power plant. I had the honor to go on this, conference with the U.S. delegation that was made up with Michael Zweig from AFT, which is American Federation of Teachers. he's also on the steering committee of U.S. Labor Against the War. He's also a professor at State College in New York. Bill Shortell is the president of the Central Connecticut Labor Council. He's a machinist. Jim Norris, who's the president of the United Steelworkers out in California, which is head of all of the oil workers out there, which is key if you're talking about Iraq. And then also I went with Michael Eisenscher, who's the director of U.S. Labor Against the War. And I went with a fellow veteran, T.J. Bonomo, who was a former intelligence officer in the U.S. Army. Myself and T.J. were the only two people that weren't in a labor organization or a labor, or came from a labor background. And for us to be able to participate in this conference was unbelievably humbling. My experience of Iraq was a lot of pointing my weapons at the Iraqi people, a lot of oppressing, and it wasn't helping them. And it was an amazing experience to sit and commune with the Iraqi people, have tea, and listen to their amazing stories of triumph, and the fact that they have all the odds against them, not only their government, not only the military, not only the occupation, but also different militias in their area. They've had multiple leaders killed over the last couple of years. So just so you know, there was over 200 representatives there at the conference from all over Iraq. I'm going to read a list of the different fields that they came from. There's the Iraqi's oil and gas industry, port unions, electrical generation and distribution industry, construction, public sector, transportation, communication, education, railroads, service and healthcare industries, machinist and metalworking sectors, petrochemical industries, civil engineers, writers and journalists, food oil workers, tailors, and students. There are also a group of women, multiple groups of women unions that were represented at the conference. And they came together and they basically wanted just a couple things. One, they want their rights underneath the International Labor Organization and underneath their new constitution. Two, they didn't want an ethnic or sectarian government. Three, they wanted an end to the occupation. Let me sure I get all of them. Four, they dealt with the issue of privatization and the fact that when these different sectors of the public sector, 70% of Iraqi's economy is in the public sector, is privatized, the corporations bring in these third country nationals and basically bring in slave labor, leaving more workers out of work and creating more division in the country while profiting. So that kind of sums up my conference. I myself and TJ had an opportunity to go up on stage, and the first thing I did was I apologized. But I said, I'm not here for forgiveness. I'm here to take responsibility. I think that's something that we all need to start thinking about. Thank you.
Thank you. James.
Thank you very much. Aaron is going to hate me for doing this, but he is a very unusual person. I have a lot of respect personally for people who serve in the military and then dissent from that culture. The military is a culture that preaches conformity, and the dissent is not encouraged. So anytime people step out of that regimentation to take on that institution and to take a position that these guys have taken, I think they deserve our respect. So how about a hand for Aaron? And we actually worked together and had a big conference, a big public hearing on January 31st at Teamsters Hall with Iraq Veterans Against the War and other organizations that are opposing the war in Iraq, basically trying to create a dialogue with labor unions and forge an alliance that we're very confident is going to continue to grow and we're going to continue to support each other. Jobs with Justice is basically a coalition of labor unions and community groups and religious organizations, students, civic groups, and policy groups that are part of what we do, which is to ensure that the right of workers to organize is respected and is honored. But the important thing that we do is to really begin to situate labor struggles in the broader context of our community interests. I think part of what has gone wrong in the United States for the longest time is that corporations have essentially controlled the discourse and around the workers' right to organize, and it's been a very effective strategy that confines the struggle between companies and unions. When a corporation wants to marginalize workers, wants to fight against the right to organize, it's always the union. It's the company fighting the union. And it's as if the union itself is doesn't have any other characteristic. You know, it's just an entity. It doesn't, you know, workers don't live in communities. There's nothing, you know, they're just workers who belong to a union. And so historically, when the struggle is framed as a union versus the corporation, it typically, obviously, disadvantages the union because corporations have spent decades trying to marginalize labor unions, trying to demonize labor unions. And so for a lot of people, many people still have to learn what a union is and why unions are important. And corporations have benefited from the demonization that they've spent so much money doing. So what we say as Jobs with Justice is that when a company is marginalizing workers, they essentially, they're waging war against the rest of us. They're really waging war against the community. When workers stop bringing money into these communities, when workers can't get benefits on the job, the burden falls on the community. Workers are the lifeblood of these neighborhoods. When they stop bringing money, local institutions are compromised. Whether it's a place of worship, a church, a mosque, a synagogue, those institutions play a very vital role in keeping those neighborhoods alive and providing services, after-school programs, soup kitchens, and shelters for battered women. You can, you know, the list goes on. Local stores, your hardware stores, and barbershops. And so when workers stop bringing money into those neighborhoods, those institutions get compromised. So we have a very simple message to community leaders and to civic leaders is that if you're interested in building strong communities, if you're interested in maintaining the integrity of your neighborhoods, you better show up at that picket line. You better come out and support workers who are at the Congress Hotel demanding justice. You better come out and support workers at Aramark. You better come out and this is in your interest. And every time we've done that in recent years, we've won. I mean, the whole living wage campaign in Chicago, although Mayor Daley vetoed that living wage, it passed by an overwhelming vote in the city council of 35-14 because we said to Walmart, this is not a fight between you and the United Food and Commercial Workers. This is a fight. You're picking a fight with the communities in Chicago. And that's, so the face of opposition to Walmart and the force of this demand that big box stores pay a living wage became community leaders from African American communities, from Latino communities, and from religious organizations. And so we just think it's a very effective strategy grounded in the mutual interest of both labor unions and the community. A recent struggle that we're involved in right now is with charter school teachers in Chicago who want to join, who just recently on April 3rd voted, but 75% that they wanted to join a union. In fact, my comrade is here, Hugo Hernandez, who's been doing a lot of the organizing, and we're working with him. And you know, once again, going to community organizations, to religious leaders, and saying that you know, the right of a teacher to join a union, the right of a person to join a union, does not stop at the doorstep of a charter school. If you want to experiment with education, fine. If you want to experiment with charter schools, but that does not negate the right of that school teacher to belong to a union. So what we're doing essentially is it's very important to note that the charter school movement is comprised of, you know, essentially two main forces. You've got ideologues, corporate ideologues, individuals who are driven by an anti-union agenda. They're pushing charter schools as a back doorway to de-unionize public education. But you also have well-meaning parents who have some concerns about public education, some legitimate grievances and complaints about public education, who right now just want to try anything, and charter schools have been sold as a kind of alternative, and so it has that kind of it's a seductive thing for people who are experiencing frustrations with public education. So we want to make sure that those parents, that alliance, it's an unholy alliance between anti-union ideologues, corporate ideologues who want to destroy labor unions, and parents who otherwise have no beef with unions but just want better schools for their kids. And so we look at the parents as our allies, and part of our strategies has been to really develop a strong bond between the union and the parents. In fact, next week the parents have an action on the north side to support the teachers. And so why this is important in this moment is that there's a sense that, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's feeling this kind of, it's a paradoxical moment, because at the macro level of politics, there's sort of this window that appears to have opened up with this radical, I don't want to call it radical, but a momentous electoral shift that has taken place in the United States that creates, at the very least, an opportunity for things to happen on the progressive side in terms of reforming labor laws and pushing a more enlightened agenda. And so there's that positive side. But that's being, I think, undermined by this crisis that we're facing, the economic crisis that affects, I think there's so much pressure that gets put on families and on people that sometimes it's very difficult to mobilize them. But there's also a vulnerability. In this moment, people get very vulnerable because they're being told that you're losing jobs. If no jobs, any effort to unionize, you know, why are you creating, you know, unemployed people aren't supposed to be making demands about good wages and so forth. When you're out of work, you don't have the luxury to choose. So they, the corporate strategy is to portray any pressures that you put on the company to pay better wages, to recognize workers, to pay a living wage, as obstructionist, and you know, don't you understand that we're in a crisis right now, and this is, you can't be making all these demands. So they understand that communities and workers feel very vulnerable in this moment, and sometimes people buy into that. They tend to think that when there's an economic crisis, somehow you shouldn't be asking for dignity at work. You shouldn't be asking for decent wages because the company might go someplace else, or something like that. And so we wanna be able to, I think, strategically to deal with that, to let people know that good wages, good paying wages, are going to be central to reviving the economy. It is precisely the low wage economy. You know, we're hearing a lot in the broad analysis of the economic collapse. We hear about the bankers on Wall Street Yes, there are bad people. They've done terrible things to the economy. We hear about the mortgage crisis. But at the center of this is really the fact that the United States has made a dramatic shift from high-paying jobs to low-wage jobs. American workers increasingly are unable to buy products that they're making. And so the economic collapse itself cannot be analyzed outside of this general context in which people are making less and less money. And so we can't summon the low-wage bottom feeders in this moment and say, oh, we're desperate, but we want to revive the economy. Why don't you come in and give us low-wage jobs? That just, it's foolish. And so the idea of good-paying jobs has to be part and parcel of the economic stimulus that everybody is talking about. And certainly the right to unionize has to be part of that effort, that we want to force corporations that have made off like bandits in this environment to start paying a decent wage. And so the teachers, the charter teachers campaign, I think we want to set an example here that we need to be in solidarity with those teachers because it is in the interest of the community, in the interest of the workers, to be able to freely join a union and negotiate good terms for employment.
Thank you, James. I want to ask one or two questions briefly. Chuck mentioned this idea of perpetual crisis, and now James is also talking about how the crisis is affecting sort of how you even view organizing generally. It feels like it's a step backward, even affecting more because it makes it more difficult for people to organize. And what I want to ask everybody is, how does the Employee Free Choice Act play into just a short 2 to 3 minutes in relation to today's where your organizations are? And Aaron, this might be a little different for you, but and maybe you can talk a little bit further about what kind of the demands and the conversations about what was necessary while you were at the convention, what they were talking about in terms of what they would need there. So yeah, about 2 to 3 minutes, how does your organization basically has approached the Employee Free Choice Act? Would you like to begin, Abraham?
We're a small union now. There was a time when we were much bigger and faced some pretty serious attacks. And our membership really began diminishing maybe a decade and a half after, labor began being undercut about a decade and a half after the real attacks on kind of leftist unions were at their fiercest in the 50s. EFCA to us is, it isn't a cure-all. Even though we're putting a lot of resources into it and we're moving our members to make sure this gets passed, we also have no delusions that it won't actually take a fight. I think of any union right now, I mean, we're ready to do militant action to make sure it gets passed, but it's not a cure-all. Do folks know about it? Do folks know? It's the Employee Free Choice Act. It's getting a lot of press from the business side, obviously, because they think the sky is falling. So it's not a cure-all. But it's an opportunity. It would provide an opportunity to build power again among working people in this country. That I think we need to understand it as such, that it's only a means to an end, that the end has to be worker power and rebuilding worker power in this country. And I mean, and kind of in light of what James just said, it's really worker and community power, right? We can't separate those workers from the communities in which they live. It's about people having self-determination again, and this is one way we can open up a window to allow folks to begin to come together in a real way that that they can build power. We're way behind the rest of the world, the rest of the industrialized world, in terms of labor law, like labor law that actually, you know, protects people when they choose to organize. It's also key to economic recovery. There can be no economic recovery. I mean, and James just pointed out, you know, we're not interested in bottom feeders, as he put it. You know, we want good living wage jobs, and the only way to really demand that is if we have power. And so it's acutely tied to the economic recovery. In the 30s and 40s, as the economy improved, it went hand in hand with union density. As union density increased, so did wages, so did working conditions, and therefore so did the standard of living. That will be what happens again. Otherwise, we'll fail at more and more bailouts without actually being able to have workers who benefit from any the workers won't recover. And we see EFCA as potentially being again a window that opens a chance to worker recovery or building power that would lead to true economic recovery that actually means worker recovery as well.
Similar to Abraham, a lot of unions of people on the left view EFCA as a great thing. I hope EFCA passes. I mean, it'll be good for people, but it's not going to lessen the extent to which business fights us. If it passes, there'll be some short window where it'll be enforced, and there'll be huge periods of time where it's tied up in courts, and then another 40 years where business figures out how to maneuver around it and screw workers. So while I hope it passes, and some unions are putting a lot of energy into it, I think that it would be a mistake for us to change our approach from organizing workers to putting all of our effort into trying to pass a law. That the real approach has to be, how do we train more workers to be leaders in a movement, to organize more workers, and to fight a long-term fight in a very strategic way where we can organize a million people at a time rather than small numbers in isolated shops. So I hope EFCA passes, but frankly, I think that the people on the left need to understand that it's really about how do you build up workers' organizations, train working class leaders, and have big long-term fights where you can really mobilize hundreds of thousands and millions of people.
I kind of want to respond from two angles. One angle is when we did War's Real Impact a couple months ago. I had a brother veteran come home, and he works for Comcast, and he can't form a union. And so he fights for this quote-unquote democracy in another country, and then he comes home, and he can't even be a part of a union in his own country. And I think that makes it really clear that how important this Employee Free Choice Act is. What was said earlier about workers and community, I think that's something that I can't put enough stress on. How much these strong communities of workers affected the communities that they were from. The oil workers in Basra, just the fact that they have enough power to sustain their work, but also that they have a women's segment of their union that on International Women's Day was able to go out into the public and make a stand for women's rights. It's something unheard of in that area. And I think that's how much power that union has behind it in that community. And I think us continually to relate to communities and the working force is really important. And the first resolution that the conference passed was a resolution to form an international front against wars, economic blockade, and prevention of union rights. So I think it's pretty clear where the Iraqis stand on that, and I think an injury to one is an injury to all. That's pretty clear. Thanks.
I think too often we fall victim to false choices. You know, the Employee Free Choice Act is not, you know, the cure-all, as everybody has just alluded to, and so it's not whether it should be pursued or not. It's really where the emphasis goes. I think the debate should be how much time and effort should go into it. But there's no denying that corporate strategies over the years, elaborate strategies to undermine labor unions, to undermine the right of workers to organize, have been very, very effective. And they're really, one cannot understand the enormity of it. I mean, the number of workers in the United States who are unionized right now, something like 7.5 percent of the workforce is unionized. You know, 11% if you throw in public sector workers, and a lot of that has to do with there are other issues, globalization and et cetera, but at the center of this are really elaborate strategies that corporations have pursued to undermine the right of workers to organize. One out of five workers gets fired for trying to join a union. The penalties have become so minuscule, so negligible, that for most employers, you know, the penalties for violating labor law, penalties for firing workers who are trying to join a union, have just become another cost of doing business. There is no deterrence. And this is a fundamental right, folks. I mean, this is a fundamental constitutional right to associate. You know, I mean, have free speech, assembly, the association conflated together. So it's a right that really is at the center of democracy itself, and we have to take seriously this effort to liberate workers to be able to form unions, to join unions freely. But it also should be a big lesson for labor unions. If the Employee Free Choice Act does not pass, if it fails to pass, that failure should reflect on the relationship that labor has cultivated with Democrats in the Congress. The amount of money that labor unions give Democrats should by now have produced a cadre of leaders in the Congress who are out front and talking about this every day and cultivating other members of Congress and building leadership. And really, the Employee Free Choice Act should be in the DNA of members of Congress who are getting union money. But as you see Sunday after Sunday at those talk shows, you know, those of you who wake up to watch news in the mornings, Sunday mornings, you know, they're not even conversant about what the FCA is. They can't even put up a modicum of defense when Southern senators, right-wing senators like Richard Shelby are attacking the UAW and accusing the UAW of destroying the auto industry. And they say, everything has to be at the table. Yes, we got to take a look at those contracts perhaps and see what can be done. And, you know, it's like... the failure to defend workers, the failure to defend unions, the failure it's almost embarrassing. You know, I'm like, I get up and I say, why can't Senator Schumer, Chuck Schumer, call down the street in the Congress, you know, a few blocks from where he is, this AFL-CIO office, call him up and say, hey, I'm going to show up on George Stephanopoulos' office. I mean, a show on Sunday morning. What are my talking points about the bailout of Chrysler or the UAW? You know, how should I respond to the Southern senators who are accusing the union of destroying the industry? No conversation about who makes decisions in Detroit. Who decided to invest in the SUV culture? Billions of dollars in advertising to get Americans hooked on SUVs. Who decides to commission the design of a car and approve it? Unions? Is that a union decision? And yet the failure to adjust to changing times, the writing has been on the wall about oil prices for quite some time. The failure of management and the owners of these corporations in Detroit to appreciate the coming energy crisis and to invest in a disastrous, I mean, the fateful decision to go with SUVs when everybody else was investing in hybrids is at the center of this collapse. But these folks don't mention it. Anyway, I get really exercised about that. But the point of the matter is that if the Employee Free Choice Act doesn't pass, labor unions should reevaluate this relationship and really make some decisions as to whether it's really wise to make this kind of investment and get so little for it.
Okay. I want to ask one more question, and then I'll open up to Q&A. And I want each one of you to think about this. As Abraham just brought up this memory of how we see labor unions during the 1930s, and a few of the reference from the Iraqi International Labor Conference, and this memory of the 1930s for labor, for me and Parpas more generally, really brings up the strongest moment for labor in the United States. But this is a moment that at the same time where what I feel and what we in Platypus feel is potentially forgotten, is that this was also the moment where labor was intricately bound up with the struggle against capitalism, or the struggle for socialism. My question to you all is, why is it the case that today it feels like it is not, or has it become irrelevant? And additionally, what are the consequences of losing that? And I'll give you all 3 minutes, like, or a few more. But maybe James, you would like to begin?
I'm trying to process the question.
Okay, would you like me to repeat the question?
Yes, please.
I'm bringing up the memory of the 1930s as a moment where US labor was at its strongest. And labor during this period basically was intricately and more strongly bound up with the struggle against capitalism or the struggle for socialism. So my question is, why is it the case that today that's not the struggle or the large, ambitious vision for labor? And is it irrelevant, or potentially what are the consequences that has been lost?
Well, I think what's interesting is recent polls that show that people are not as afraid of socialism as the establishment seems to think they are. 53% of Americans in a recent poll said they favor capitalism, and I think it was 37% favor socialism. You know, I mean, high numbers considering the pounding that socialism gets in the United States. But I think that, you know, it's not just labor unions, it's the larger body politic in the United States, I think in large measure because of the Cold War. And I think, and some of the socialist models that have not been as exemplary and attractive, and so that sort of has, I think, affected the ability of people here to have a deeper and more serious discourse on socialism. But there are organizations in this country that are everywhere pushing. But we've got a media that doesn't give access to these sort of ideas and these points of view. I think that now there's an opportunity, I think, in part because we have a generational shift. There are a lot of people, young people, who are not even around when the Cold War ended. They don't know what communism is. When the right wing is out there saying Barack is socialist, they don't have memories of the Cold War, you know. And so when the right wing is saying socialism, it's not really resonating with them. So this may be a moment of opportunity to really start a more in-depth and serious discussion of really explaining. We may debate what to call it. I don't know if you want to call it, you know, communism now or socialism, whether it's dated. That's a debate for another day. But I think that in terms of locating power, and really challenging this notion of private ownership and private control, who should control the means of production? I think it's a conversation. I think that's quite. This is a propitious moment to bring it up in the United States.
Yeah.
Going to this conference, I think I just recently spoke over at Roosevelt University, and they had someone there from the Labor Union Historical Society, and they were talking about May Day, and they were also talking about the Haymarket Massacre and what had brought that massacre together. And a lot of it earlier in that day and that week, there was a huge gathering of labor organizations from across the entire United States. And I guess I look to that as an inkling of what was happening in Iraq as these labor federations gathered from across the United States. And, you know, if we can, I mean, I'm not, like James said, I think there's all types of ways to argue this, but 70% of Iraqi's oil is in the Iraqi's economy is in the public sector. They're coming from a quote-unquote supposed socialist position. Before that, well, that's what Saddam Hussein called himself. So that's truth. That's what was quote-unquote. I'm not going to say that was what I would call socialism. And before that, the Communist Party in the country was the strongest political force in the entire country, and I think those roots are still existing when these people have an opportunity to voice their opinions. So I think what I saw is that their movement, their labor movement, is very much tied with their political movement, and a lot of it has to do with keeping the economy and the public sector, because that's where they know that when they know if they lose the oil to the private sector that they're losing the future of Iraq in a lot of ways. And I think that they've been really clear about the economy being sectioned off and sold away to the private sector. So I guess maybe it's kind of resonant in that space. I'll end it with that.
I think that the left, broadly speaking, and the labor movement had something of an alliance in this country from the 1870s until the 1940s. And with the in the Cold War, that alliance got broken. And the socialists, communists, anarchists, what have you, were, in some cases like the UE, chased out or split and kind of been chased out. At my union, they were actually chased out. In his union, they stayed in UE. But I think that in some cases they were chased out, some cases they fled, some cases they went their own separate way. And in many cases, the people that had in the 1920s left New York City and went to St. Louis and started and got jobs in the factories and organized as communists to build a union, like they didn't UE, I think in cases, or like they got jobs in restaurants in New York City and organized, that stopped, and the ideological left abandoned the unions, and the unions abandoned the ideological left. And that's kind of stayed that way for the last 60 years. There have been times in different unions where that's come back together, but for the most part, it's stayed separate. I think it's an oversimplification, though, to say that the ideas have gone, because I think that there are lots and lots and lots of union leaders from the level of shop steward up to the level of president of a union that have very radical ideas about the economy and about politics. I'm not sure they express themselves by calling themselves socialist or communist or what have you, but the idea of struggling against capital is there. Having a huge vision of what's accomplishable or what's possible is what's lacking. And I think when the ability to organize, the anger that leads us to organize, and the vision come back together, we'll have an ideological left again in the labor movements. But we're not there right now. We're slow in bits and pieces of the labor movement that's coming back together. But as you can see by looking at the labor movement right now, there are parts of it that believe they should essentially be the HR department for bosses, corporate unionism. And there are parts that are really don't want to do anything, frankly, that are stuck in their ways that they've been stuck in for 50 years. And there are parts that really want to fight. And the labor movement will shake this out and figure out which way it's going to go and whether it's going to become the labor movement of the 1960s, stagnance, again, or it's going to become the labor movement of the 1930s, will be seen by people in those unions, working class leaders, either developing a vision and developing real anger or not.
Abraham?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what my union's leaders today would say, national leaders, not grassroots leaders, how they would answer your question. And I'll tell you why. Because I mean, our history kind of has been kind of surrounded by mistakes made from all different directions. So from the sectarian left, the communists and the socialists, and then the kind of House of Labor, the labor establishment. When I mean, when we were in the heat of McCarthyism, the communists inside and outside our union, right? And you have to understand that our constitution is written such that it's really clear that we don't discriminate based on political beliefs. So yes, there was an element of there were folks who were in leadership who were active communists and belonged to left parties, but that I think the assessment that that's what our union was, or that that's what labor was, even at the height of communism in this country, at the height of kind of left power in this country, I think is a mistake, or is maybe kind of a, at least for our union, is maybe kind of an outsider's perspective versus an insider's perspective, because on the inside, I mean, the Communist Party was, again, both folks within the union and outside the union. The sectarian left was pushing our union to join with the House of Labor, in order to fight off McCarthyism, and essentially we would have ceased to exist had we chosen to do that. Had we chosen to go in that direction, and I think it would have been a loss to the labor movement as a whole, because you would have lost, you know, the last national union that had that kind of militant rank and file union, you know, thread of rank and file militant unionism left in the country. Of course, the IWW is now organizing, but in terms of national unions, there would be none of those CIO militant rank and file led unions left had we chosen to do that. So the attacks were coming from both sides, and the mistakes were being made from, from all over. Were being made all over. There's a story that's told over and over and over in our union about, and you see the quote different places, in art and so on, but of GE's president at the end of World War II, and I don't remember the guy's name, saying something like, and we. You know, at that point, we had organized. I mean, we had a huge chunk of GE's workers organized into the UE, and he made this statement about, you know, we've got our country has two biggest enemies or something like this, the Soviets abroad and labor at home, and you know, and that then began, you know, their kind of campaign along with his friend McCarthy, right? I mean, this kind of collusion in government and industry to squelch labor, right? It was clearly understood by those industry heads that the problem wasn't necessarily communism at home, the problem was labor, right? And I think that's key to kind of understanding what that time period was actually about. It was about class war first, right? And then kind of left ideology second. And we need to be careful kind of in moving forward as a movement for social justice, as a movement for kind of to reestablish left politics in this country in a really significant way, to understand that was what it was about, right? It was clear in their minds that it was a fight between industry, the boss, and labor, the workers, right? It was never, at least not in the beginning, was not about the communists, or certainly not the communists at home, right? It was labor at home that they were really afraid of. Do I have a few seconds? One thing I want to point out is, at least in our union, the reason, at least this is from my perspective, but I think historians who've written about this period of our union tend to tell the same story, but the reason left politics grew in our union was because of the tradition of militant struggle. That is ultimately what builds leadership, right? And that is what builds political analysis as well, is engaging folks in militant aggressive struggle against the boss, right? Against the boss, against the mayors, against the city halls. That's what builds leadership. And ultimately, that's what builds their politics. That's how folks get engaged in radical politics. Radical being kind of beginning to understand their problems from the root cause and addressing their problems from the root cause, right? That's Marx's phrase, not mine. I just want to give credit where it's due. And we believe that, right? Like, we believe that as a union, we believe that as a left union. I mean, we should believe that as leftists all over, right? That this is actually how we move folks' politics, we move folks' analysis, is by engaging them in that struggle, is engaging them in militant struggle. That has to be key, kind of, in the road forward. We have to understand that.
Okay, thank you. I will open up to questions, and then I'll give you all, actually, after a few questions, 3 minutes just to close up remarks after the questions. Anybody has any questions? Omer will come by and see.
Thank you. Marty Canis from Labor Beat. I want to pick up where James left off.
I just want to clarify, sorry.
Yes.
Sorry for interrupting you. Let's try to keep the questions within 1 to 2 minutes.
Sure. How about the brainwashing the corporate machine has done to the workers in America here? And it's an EFCA question, and I'd especially like Chuck to answer this one, because I liked your answer on the AFL-CIO. Have they ever thought that it's going to be a majority postcard campaign, right? So 51% of your shop signs their postcards and gets a union. Have they considered that 51% of any shop would desert? Because I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's 60-something desert campaigns going in this direction. Do they see people going out the back door of the AFL-CIO just as quick as they come in? If they thought this through, that sometimes the AFL-CIO people really see as a problem?
Okay, I'll try my best to answer that. My union's not part of the AFL-CIO, first off. I'm not even sure we're part of Change the Win right now. Right now, if a majority of people do sign for a desert, a boss has the option to unrecognize the union, which would then take a fight to get recognition back. That's right now under the law. So I'm not sure they're thinking that far ahead about desert campaigns. Having gone through fights like that before, where other unions particularly try to raid and desert, I think it's really short-sighted and sad to see unions, rather than focusing on organizing part of the 93% of public sector workers that are not union and have no organization, more concerned with stealing, more concerned with trying to convince workers to come join them. Than anything else. I think it's just a very sad state in the labor movement when that's where we're at. And that's kind of where we're at right now in a lot of cases. I know that's not directly related to EFCA, but like I said, I don't really know that answer. There are company unions set up now.
Can you just make sure it's a question? Okay.
There are unions right now that act as company unions.
Next question.
This is mainly a question for James, but I would like to leave it open for the whole panel. You talked about how labor organizing was inextricably linked to the community. And I just wanted to know from your guys' perspective of how far would our imagination for a community go within the city, within the county, the state, nation, international? How far should our imaginations really stretch to envision a community that we all share?
Well, I think, you know, this has been part of, I mean, since we're critiquing labor now, it's been a problem. I think short-sightedness it's well chronicled, so I'm not making this up, that for too long, American labor has neglected the international dimension to this struggle. Part of that was the Cold War, but I don't want to get into that. And that, a lot of great opportunities for international relationship building with labor unions in the global South in particular were lost. So because what we're seeing right now is that literally because of globalization, countries in the global South that are struggling to build democracy, that are also sort of building their own democracy project, that's being threatened because the company comes into town and says, if you want me to build a factory here, you're going to have to help us by creating a business-friendly environment. That means get rid of unions, get rid of those child welfare advocates, get rid of environmentalists who are going to be concerned about what's being discharged into the air, into the water, get rid of those women's advocates who are going to be concerned about the treatment of women, those human rights activists who are going to be concerned. So you see an assault on the very building blocks for democracy as a condition for that company coming to situate itself in a location in the global South. This is the kind of stuff that global trade agreements should have been addressing, but also I think that in a proactive kind of way, labor unions should have been engaging and really strengthening, building strong partnerships with the global South to prevent this from happening.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Just to speak about community for a minute, I do agree with James that it's important that we start to think about how do you actually organize internationally, right? Like how do you, in my union, how do you organize Hiltons worldwide, right? Not just in a city, not just in the country, but worldwide. But getting back to the question of like community, I think it's important that we remember that unions are merely a vehicle for working class power, and we should not get bogged down that a union is a contract, or a union is a single group of workers at a workplace. It's the power that we can build as working class people everywhere. To that end, we can do amazing organizing in communities to support politics that are important to workers or worker struggle themselves. I think there are a couple great organizations that do that in local levels. In Connecticut, there's an organization called Connecticut Center for a New Economy that works very closely with the unions at Yale and Yale New Haven Hospital. And that community organization has built itself up to the point where it can get people, including union members, elected to office in New Haven. But it can also turn out community allies to large scale fights. An example would be the CCNA turned out thousands of people to support immigrant rights in the city of New Haven and ID cards. So like they turned out to get lots and lots of people ID cards. Not just undocumented immigrants, not just immigrants themselves, but people born and raised in America to get these ID cards that would basically be a status in New Haven where the police wouldn't ask you for your, identification as a citizen anymore, but your ID card. I mean, that was done through CCNA and the unions. Another example would be when the workers at Yale were fighting for their contract, they had a picket, they had a strike, but they also had 700 community allies, students, citizens, show up and do a 700-person civil disobedience where 700 people got arrested en masse, right? Saying, this is our community, this is our city, we're gonna stop Yale if we have to with our bodies. And that was broadening the definition of a union. That was saying the whole city is the union. And I think that's what we should be doing in Chicago as well.
Anybody else like to answer that question? Okay. Any more questions? Carrie, Omer, okay.
I've just been sort of asking everybody I can, given the difficulties in the American economy with its sort of service economy, the end of the Fordist model of production, what do you think is the feasibility of a debtor's union, like debtors versus creditors, as the framework to work in? I mean, that seems like that could cross barriers of, you know, class and students, the student labor difficulties. Do you see that as a feasible thing?
Is that for everybody? Anybody would like to address that?
Debtors union.
Sure, jump in.
Yes, there's a possibility of that. There's actually historical precedent in the U.S. Kind of similar, you know, foundation of thinking that led to organizing unemployed folks in the 30s. So councils of the unemployed, speaking of the left, right? I mean, councils of unemployed were a way of engaging folks who had been laid off in mass layoffs in struggles that they, you know, that were in their self-interest. So it's not that much of a leap from that. The problem, though, the difference between now and the 30s, though, is the political context, I would say, more than anything. So it'll, you know, I think it's possible, right, this historical precedent, but then the level of political education that you would need to do to begin to really build that kind of organization is, like, organization as a verb rather than a noun, is going to be huge. But they faced, you know, they faced problems too in the 30s in organizing. So it's not like, I mean, we have cell phones these days, right? We've got a lot of advantages over those folks. So it's very possible. And I think at least that's one example that kind of would indicate that, yeah, people can be organized along those kinds of very unpredictable lines, but it's really clearly in their self-interest.
There's an institutional variation to this, which is the whole debt. I don't want to use the word forgiveness. The whole like Jubilee 2000, for example, the whole countries in the global south organizing to on the whole question of indebtedness and
you mean international debt generally?
Yeah, I'm talking about international debt that, you know, countries got up and organized, and in fact, many countries got billions of dollars. What's the word I'm looking for? I'm blanking out. Debt cancellation, like Jubilee 2000. So I think that you can look at that as a kind of a model where countries got together and said we can, through moral suasion, moral pressure, students got involved in university campuses, and so there was a sort of an internationalization of this whole question, and presented some really forceful arguments around why some of this debt was illegitimate, because poor people in the global south were being asked to pay debts that had absolutely nothing to do with the victims of apartheid being asked to pay a debt that was accrued by their own oppressors who were buying weapons to oppress them with. And so there was a sort of strong moral dimensions to it that I think something, a movement of debtors could borrow from.
Anybody else like to address it? No?
Well, since we kind of mentioned some international perspectives a couple times, in Iraq they have a poor people's union, and they also have a unemployed union. And I think, you know, in regards to answering your question, I think it's all a matter of organizing. You know, I look at coming back from that experience of being in Iraq and just being completely humbled by the fact that they're dealing with everything is on their back, everything is against them. You know, you're talking about having cell phones and, you know, quick communications. You know, their power goes out. You know, most cities don't have power. you know, we're talking about they're dealing with how to organize, and yet they're still doing it. So the question is, are we going to go out and organize it? You know, that's the question. Are we going to go out and do the hard work and start climbing these mountains to organize?
Yeah. There was one question down here.
Hi. There seems to be the general sentiment on the panel that the Employee Free Choice Act is not really very far-reaching in terms of how much power it might help unions to have. What possible changes in legislation would you see as something that would help unions to have more power in the future, whether that be modifications to existing legislation or a new piece of legislation that would be different from the Employee Free Choice Act?
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I apologize for being the one who maybe started the critique of EFCA so strongly. There is a lot of potential to build power through EFCA if it were passed without being watered down. Like, you know, I'm sure unions can come up with, like, we could dream up all sorts of legislation. I think my critique is actually that it's not legislation that that will be the cure-all, right? It's actually going out there and organizing, right? I mean, it's about the organizing. And so it's an opportunity to organize, but then it doesn't, we could be completely lazy after EFCA gets passed in its, you know, in the best form possible and never organize another person. I mean, the responsibility is on us. It's not on some legislation actually, you know, solving all the problems, right? The strongest critique I've heard of EFCA, just, I mean, purely from an ideological standpoint, is about worker struggle, right? If workers don't have to struggle anymore to form an organization that fights the boss, how strong is that organization actually going to be, right? So, again, I mean, we could dream up legislation in which all workers were organized into a union, and yet they never had to struggle, and therefore they'll never have real power. It's about organizing to build power. That's where we start. Like, that's the front end of this train. And I think EFCA is one of those cars that, you know, is gonna kind of go down the rail with us in that direction. But it has to be about building power. It has to be about organizing first. And then we use those things as mechanisms to get to that point.
Thank you. Anybody else? Dave?
Yeah, I think I'm disturbed by the premise that struggle needs to be hard and bloody all the time. That if there's a way that I can bypass, if I have a choice between, you know, having to run 5 miles and a car stops by and picks me up, I don't have a problem with riding that car so I can get to my destination faster. So I think we need to get out of this idea that punishing employers who are getting in the way of workers organizing. If 1 out of 5 workers gets fired for trying to organize and you stop that from happening, you're not making the worker lazy. You're getting rid of the impunity within which the employer class has operated over the years, right? There's been a cycle of impunity in which they are doing all kinds of nefarious stuff, captive audience meetings designed to demonize. I mean, they show these videos that are so vile, suggesting labor unions are a subversive notion in America. You know, the firings that go on. I mean, this stuff is so antithetical to what all of us think of as democracy. And so getting rid of that and easing the process of organizing is not going to spoil workers into thinking, geez, you know, I don't have to struggle anymore. But let's not look at struggle as an end within in itself. So I think we need to be careful with that.
Aaron, I saw you grabbing the mic.
Well, I would just say with any progressive struggle, you know, one step forward doesn't mean the struggle ends. And I think we can appreciate the steps that have been made. And if EFCA, if Employee Free Choice passes, then I think that's a you know, a well-appreciated step that's been made, but it's not the only step. You know, so I agree with that. We have to keep organizing, but I'm not going to, you know, agree that by persecution or, I mean, just look at the situation in Iraq, you know, I don't think they feel that their struggle, the fact that they have union leaders killed, you know, and that the leader of the conference had been in a car bomb a couple weeks before, that is actually helping them in their struggle. So I just think it's a matter of organizing regardless.
Chuck, please.
Let me say, I'm not against EFCA because it doesn't create struggle. I think, though, that the problem with EFCA is, and by the way, like I said, I still hope it passes. There's an example. One of the provisions of EFCA is that there'll be binding arbitration. Right now, one of the problems that unions face when they organize, and maybe Abraham would know something about this, is that if a union wins an election, roughly half the time it wins an election and the workers win recognition and say they have an official union, they don't get a contract about half the time, which means as they go through this big fight, they win recognition and they end up never getting a contract and never getting improvements to their day-to-day life. What EFCA calls for is binding arbitration, meaning if you don't get a contract within a year, it will go, your contract will go before some judge who will tell you what you win or what your contract is for the life of the contract. While, you know, I know sometimes that gets to be a compromise that people fight for, I think it has the capacity to end up in a situation where unions are no longer having fights to win really good contracts, but instead of relying on courts. I do think that it's important that we don't give up our power as workers, our collective power as part of the working class, to the court system and to politicians, and say that we're going to rely on these people to be our saviors and to do the right thing. You know, I want people to have a better life. I organized. I was fired for organizing a union when I was 19. And I think that it does really matter that the power we have as workers comes from ourselves and not from the law and not from courts. Those things are shields. I read a book when I was young called The Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, where it talks that the law is a shield and your union is a sword. It's the weapon with which you can fight with, and the laws with which you can defend yourself. And I hope that the laws there to defend us, but I think that we can't rely on just that. And it makes me nervous that that unions that do very, very little organizing because it's hard are the unions that are fighting the hardest for the law change. It makes me nervous that we're going to go down a path where unions rely on the law rather than the power of the workers themselves. I want to be in a movement where we're fighting as workers with our own power, our own might, our own ideas, and not relying on the goodness of the law, because that law can change. Our power is what we have.
Another question.
I'm wondering, any of the panelists or all can speak to the question of, we're about 8 days from May Day, and the fight for legalization of the some 12 million workers without, mostly workers without papers in the U.S. Goes on. In fact, it was their fight that in 2006 made May Day a workers' holiday again with some meaning. Up until then, I mean, everybody in this room who's been to anyone over the years know that it was gone. It wasn't part of the labor movement. So we've got it back, but the fight still goes on for legalization. I believe it's one of the most important fights for the labor movement. That unless it's taken up, unions can't go forward. So maybe and then just finally, I think I agree very much with the proposal that the way unions will be rebuilt and revitalized is
through the ranks themselves coming into action.
Can you please just read the question?
Okay. So when we're just at the beginning of that process, it'll happen over years. But if you could speak directly to the importance of this May Day, it's going to be not millions of people, but in the fight for legalization. Thank you.
Go ahead, Doug.
I would like to say, Carrie asked the question, I didn't get to really answer that, was what law would I change? I think the most important law or regulation that you could change in America right now is amnesty and a path to citizenship in the future and sensible immigration laws. That is the single most important thing unions should be fighting for. And that would dramatically increase the amount of people fighting in the workplace, fighting against the system that they live in, fighting against their landlords, fighting against police brutality, fighting to make this a better world is sensible immigration and amnesty. So I agree with you. I think it's the most important thing.
In fact, EFCA and immigration reform are intertwined. I think we can't, I think there's a, I'm bothered by the, what I'm seeing is a kind of single-mindedness that's setting in among those who are pushing the Employee Free Choice Act. And there's a debate going on. People are saying, well, can we ask for too much? Can we get immigration reform into EFCA at the same time? You know, it's going to be too much in the Congress. Let's get to EFCA and then, you know, maybe, you know, fight for the immigration reform. But they're tied together because you could liberate workers to organize, join a union through EFCA. But if you have 12 million people that continue to exert downward pressure on wages, you negate whatever effectiveness that EFCA brings to organizing. So the two are very much tied together. But it's also really about changing how we talk about immigration in this country. It has lacked political leadership. I think activists are doing a great job on the ground and so forth. But you know, there has to be a more public way that we put out the arguments out there that we for too long we've allowed corporations we've accepted the premise that corporations can go any place in the world in search of profit maximization, but it's somehow subversive for a worker to arrive at that same conclusion, that I want to go someplace else so I can increase my earnings and feed my family. We're not holding accountable decision makers in Congress, in other centers of power around the world who are making decisions on trade deals that are victimizing people in the global south and causing dislocations. We're not holding people accountable who are voting for wars. War is one of the most destabilizing, dislocating forces in the world. Millions of people now dislocated across the world because people are voting for war in the Congress. Human rights abuses, the United States being complicit in the abuse of human rights in so many countries, that's a major source of, a major reason people move about. Global warming, I can go on and on and on. You have global warming deniers in this country who don't see the connection between what's happened to the environment and millions of people are being uprooted and moving about. And so the discourse has to shift from individuals who are crossing the border, who are really symptoms, are emblems of bad policies. And so I think there needs to be a much more sophisticated way in which we're talking about immigration and locating it in a broader global context and putting the responsibility where it lies, which is in decision-making powers and decision-making centers, not just here in the United States, but on the globe.
Thank you. Anybody else would like to address that question? More questions from the audience. Okay. Going once. Gabe.
Shout.
How about that? Yeah. How about you? Get up and... Sorry.
Well, I can't do it on my own. You know, the other side accuses us of unions of kind of like, you know, skulking around and trying to figure out where we can you know, we're like, it's like a con, right? It's just like a long con where we skulk around and try to figure out where we can make the most profit and get the workers who are the most oppressed, they can pay us the, you know, pay us dues. And so I'm cautious, right? But then we need to be strategic about how to build long-term worker power, community power, long-term power, where we can really engage in fights and you know, and really turn the table. I mean, in my short lifetime of organizing, have never been part of an action where the workers and our side clearly had the power. Like it's usually been, you know, your strategy has to, you know, revolve around or kind of tiptoe around this fact that you know there's a big power differential between you and the, you know, and the massive corporation that you're fighting, until Republic, where it was very clear that, I mean, it wasn't just workers in that shop, but then it was workers countrywide, showed that there is real power in this country to win against, I mean, this behemoth of a corporation, right? The biggest bank in the country right now, the financial institution. You know, the people say that Chavez was warned long, you know, years ago, you can nationalize anything you want, just don't touch the banks. Well, and of course we went after a bank. I mean, it's like, anyway. So yes, we're thinking about how to most strategically build worker power. I don't have an answer to the little second piece of your question about are service workers now in this country kind of the, you know, the base of production? I mean, clearly, our economy is by far more complex than it was 100 years ago. But I think we're smart enough for the task as well, right? And now there are three panelists, except for me, who've mentioned international solidarity as a key part of moving worker power in this country forward. It has to be key, and it has to be part of our thinking. One of our locals in North Carolina, so our union has kind of long understood that international solidarity has to be a part of how we build power for our own members, right, and for the working class in the U.S. The folks in North Carolina, you know, have kind of applied this in a very real way, right? So that it's not just solidarity kind of for its own sake, but then it's a way to really win changes. And so we have a strategic alliance with the FAT in Mexico that are kind of a multi-issue community / labor organization, rank and file led organization in Mexico, and between them and the folks in North Carolina is a right to work state. They've come up with all sorts of interesting strategies on how to win things for each other using international laws that were put in place really for the benefit of the corporations. So, for example, the folks in Mexico sued North Carolina based on NAFTA. Who would have ever guessed, right? They used NAFTA to essentially say to North Carolina that your laws on workers are illegal, you know, based on this trade agreement, right? Because I don't know all the technicalities of it, but it basically that it gives unfair competition to someone, you know, versus someone else, and therefore North Carolina was actually being illegal. Those are the kinds of, like, we have got to start thinking like that. Like, we've got to start thinking on a global scale, for one, and we've got to start thinking about how to, you know, where our leverage is. It's about leverage, right? The point of production was always about where the most leverage could be made. Okay.
Go ahead, Chuck. I would say, while I think that lots of workers in this country, you know, should be organized, and whether they're manufacturing or service sector workers. And I would not accuse UE of skulking around looking for members wherever they could. I would say that there's a distinct difference in visions amongst various unions. And this is not to denigrate UE at all. But that about 4 months ago, the workers at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, about 1,000 people, voted overwhelmingly to join the Service Workers International Union, which is mostly a hospital union. What's amazing about that is that for 40 years, they have been organized by my union, Unite Here. And that the beautiful part about that is 4 months ago, and actually over the last 4 years, we had, in my union, about 10,000 hospital workers in my union. We're mostly hotels, casinos. We made a strategic decision to go to our members that are in hospitals and say, you would be better off in a union with lots of other hospital workers where you can organize industrially around the country. And we want to focus on hotels, casinos, and food service, the core of our union. We will not organize outside of our industry. We won't go, even if people come to us from a warehouse and say, we want to join your union, we'll say, go join the warehouse workers union. We want to organize in our industry where we can build real power and have a focus. Otherwise, we are kind of spread out all over the place without the ability to win power in that industry. So those workers at the Mayo Clinic and 4,000 workers in Toledo at nursing homes, 3,000 in Florida, we went to them and said, you should join SEIU. We'll help you conduct the vote over the last 4 years. And we've systematically helped these workers join the union they should be in. They should be allied in their industry. And it's taking a different vision. It's a vision that comes out of the 1930s, industrial unionism, that you should organize along industrial lines to build real power. And we should figure out how to do that nationwide, and then we should figure out how to do that internationally. Or at the same time, how to do that internationally. How can hotel workers in Chicago, hotel workers in New York, hotel workers in Toronto help or work with hotel workers in London and Paris and Rome and Cairo and Mumbai, right? Like, how can we build industrial power across the continents? And I think that's what we should be doing.
Thank you. James?
No, I was just going to quibble a little bit. I mean, Chapter 11 of NAFTA that I think you're alluding to is a kind of double-edged sword, because it's also been used to undo local legislation. I know California was sued by a Canadian company that makes MTBE, the additive to gasoline, because they thought that, you know, the ban on MTBE was a trade-distorting practice. And so I'm glad to see that, you know, Mexico used the law, I mean, that FANT used that law in this particular case to challenge the anti-union laws of North Carolina. But it's, I think we need to think through how some of those laws can be made more, you know, less problematic, because they always come back to bite us.
I'm gonna kind of hit 2 points.
Yeah, please.
Just in regards to immigrant rights and to Bradley's question earlier, in my my unit, my platoon, there were quite a few people that weren't citizens of the United States, Puerto Rican, or excuse me, Mexican, and actually there's one girl, Rodriguez, who snuck across the border and told me about her border crossing story. And when you're in the military, they tell you, you get to go deployed, you can get your citizenship. And when we got home, there was a list of Aguayo, Aviles, Rodriguez, Hernandez, Huerta, whole group of people in my platoon, and none of them were given their citizenship. So, I mean, I think it's really clear when we talk about immigrants' rights and veterans' rights and GI rights and workers' rights that all those things start coming together. And on that same note, when we talk about, you know, where is the point of production of this war, it starts with the soldiers, and that's where IVAW is at. I mean, we're organizing on bases across the United States and in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and we're trying to inform soldiers of their rights and help them know that they can apply for CO status, that they can get out for their mental PTSD issues, that they can resist in other forms more directly. They can go AWOL. And we're definitely a part of that struggle. I mean, one of our point of unities is that we support war resistors. So we have now 4 active duty chapters, and we're hoping to grow that. But when we talk about the point of production of war, I think it's pretty clear that that's where we're at.
Any more questions? Okay.
A clarifying point.
Yes. Hold on, Chris. Go ahead.
Just about NAFTA. I mean, we don't support NAFTA, obviously. I just want to make sure folks are clear that, yeah, and neither does the FAT. My point was only about kind of thinking strategically about the, the things that are available to us, including things that the other side really has, you know, has put in place for their to their advantage, not really to ours. So we don't.
I knew that, by the way.
No. You think we support NAFTA?
No. I was not implying that at all.
Okay. There was a question in the back. Yes.
I'd like to follow up on something that James had said, I think, in the opening remarks, maybe in the second round, I'm not sure, about the sort of traditional relationship between organized labor and the Democratic Party. And I think that a lot of union support for Obama during the election cycle, and also for the Democrats more generally, was based on the expectation of the passing of the Employee Free Choice Act. I think that the way you formulated it, James, was that labor should reconsider its relationship to the Democratic Party. And so I wanted to raise the issue of the Democratic Party as an obstacle to the labor movement in the United States that has a sort of roots in the 1930s, which was a different sort of era, and has sort of been traditionally upheld. But what do you guys think about the future of the relationship between organized labor and the Democrats?
Who would like to begin?
I've
beaten that horse a few times. I'll let somebody else.
I think that unions should make strategic decisions and not be tied to any individual party. I personally knocked on doors for Arnold Schwarzenegger in California one time. Arnold Schwarzenegger was of the two candidates, he was the only one that supported card check neutrality for casino workers. The Democratic candidate sided with the bosses. And not only trying to not support card check neutrality for casino workers, but actively denying them legal rights to organize at tribal casinos in California. Arnold Schwarzenegger took the other side. He sided with the workers. And that makes more sense than siding with a Democrat that's against unions. I'm okay with that decision.
Aaron, Abraham.
The UE doesn't endorse candidates, this is the reason. So, I'm not quite sure. I certainly can't predict what Labour's relationship with the Democratic Party is going to be in the future. I agree with James; it should be reevaluated if EFCA doesn't get passed, because then, really, we should be asking who are our allies. But I think this is kind of the danger that that these sorts of alliances with people who could end up being your targets, these kinds of very close alliances with people who could end up being your targets and who maybe by necessity should be your targets in the future. I'm being careful.
It's a tension, though. I mean, this is the age-old sort of tension that speaks to, kind of this dilemma. I think at the end of the day, it's not whether or not unions should engage the electoral arena. it's what the, where the emphasis is going to be. And I think that too often the pendulum has swung on the side of politicking and you know, campaign contributions and electoral donations, as opposed to putting that money in organizing. Because I think, you know, and we argue this a lot on our side, which is healthy. You know, when you have a candidate who is openly saying they're going to support, you know, a monumental piece of legislation like the Employee Free Choice Act, you know, who's going to, for the first time, I mean, I heard Barack Obama talking about global warming yesterday in ways that was kind of shocking to me that a president of the United States can say that so openly. And so it was refreshing to hear somebody, you know, actually embrace science. And this is a huge issue for those of us who care about the planet, and that there are clear differences between how you have a party that denied the science on global warming and a president now who's saying he's going to try to help mobilize public opinion, international opinion, to address global warming. So it comes down to those, you know, if we care about those issues, we may, from time to time, need to engage electoral politics.
Go ahead.
Just think, dealing with the general left or progressive position, I've heard a lot of argument around Obama recently, and I feel in regards to our target around movement or alliance building, I think, at least the way I see it for IBAWs, articulating ourselves against Obama is kind of wasting our time. We need to articulate ourselves of where we want to be in 5 years, and that we want immediate withdrawal of Iraq and Afghanistan, but beyond that, what do we want in regards to these wars, and what do we want in 5 years, and start articulating those visions and those strategic visions. And instead of wasting our time articulating ourselves against a president that's going to be around for most 8 years, like, the left really needs to take a real serious look at itself and say, what do we want in 20 years? What do we want in 10 years? What do we want in 5 years? What do we want next year? And start working on that.
Thank you.
What do we want? Justice. When do we want it?
Now!
With that, I guess I will request closing remarks, 2 to 3 minutes. I think that this idea of vision has already been posed, so I'll leave that to you guys. But 2 to 3 minutes, just closing up for the
I don't need that much time. I appreciate everybody coming out tonight, and I, you know, I just want all of us to be engaged in this moment. I think we're at a crossroads. Capitalism is discredited. Neoliberalism is discredited. The question now is, I mean, I worry that we were sort of unprepared, I think, for this particular moment, how to seize it and how to put forth credible alternatives. But I know that a lot of minds are engaged, people are engaged, and people are coming out to forums like this. There are thousands of these things happening across the country. We have a big meeting on May 2nd here. I'm part of a group that is called ARC 109 that's, you know, bringing people together to sort of imagine a different world and to think strategically about how we capitalize on this moment to energize each other and push for progressive radical change. And so I appreciate the fact that you all took the time to organize this and invite us to participate.
Aaron, go ahead.
I also want to say thanks for having me, and thank you for everyone that came out. It's humbling once again to be on a panel with such amazing organizers. I'm going to finish off with bringing a little bit more of a creative side to this whole thing. If you give me a second. At the end of my talk in Iraq, I read a poem I wrote, and it's actually the poem that kind of it's about a story about a boy who brought me to radicalism, or to a more radical point in my life. After I got home from deployment, I didn't say anything for about 2 years, and I didn't feel like I had a right to. I felt like the politicians and the media pundits and the generals all knew more about the war than I did, or at least that's the way they talked about it, and no one was asking the soldiers. Everybody had an opinion. No one was asking the people that walked the streets. And so I met a little boy who had lost his arm and his sight in crossfire between American soldiers and quote-unquote insurgents. And I don't know, he changed my life. And so at the end of my presentation, I read this. Ahmed Jabbar Sharif is my friend and my guardian angel. The children lining the road of Iraq begging for food fill me with guilt and cynicism and anger. Yet Ahmed, who has been raped by this war, raped of his youth, raped of his body, raped of his sight, raped of his home, raped of his freedom, has no cynicism in his thoughts. He gives love and trust without fear. He grabs my hand and yells, "Run, run, please, please run." His nine-year-old boy who wants to run. His nine-year-old boy who can't run without someone to lead him, to stop him before the curb, before the tree, before the car he cannot see. His nine-year-old boy who wants to stomp his feet and twist to pop music. His nine-year-old boy that teaches himself to play the piano. His nine-year-old boy that is a bird that knows no barbed wire. His nine-year-old boy that is my guardian angel constantly reminding me that life is for love and trust, not cynicism and anger. Ahmed Jabbar Sharif is my friend. After I read this, a man stood up in the back of the audience and started speaking in Arabic, and I was waiting for the translation. He started walking up towards the stage, and it was this place just kind of like this, and I thought, well, whatever this is, I deserve it. The man walked on stage, and the translation came through and said, "I just want to walk on stage and give these gentlemen a hug." And I started crying. And then another man stood up in the back, and he said, "We thought we were the ones that were oppressed, but now we know it is you." I think that's a real reality check for all of us here in the States about the love that kind of transcends these different ideological drifts, and I hope points to a space where we can unite and build a movement of workers and peoples that can overcome these indifferences and these persecutions and these oppressions. So thank you again for coming out. I really appreciate it.
Chuck. I don't know what to say after that. You know, I think that while it's great to be able to have forums like this and discuss, you know, ideas and politics and our hopes, I think that the work that's going to take to fundamentally change the world is really daunting and difficult and scary. And I think that the most I can say is that I would hope that each person that comes here takes it on themselves to find their role in doing that organizing. I know many of you in the audience, actually, personally, that has had the same speech given to you. That, you know, a lot of the talk has been about community and outreach, and that people outside of individual unions can play a role, and that's true. People outside of individual unions can play a role and can be a large part of fights for worker power. And I would encourage you all, if this is what you believe in, is to find that place in the labor movement, in a union, in community organizations, that you can go and do the hard, difficult work that needs to be done to build worker power. So, do it. Do something. Do the work of actually organizing. Anybody that needs shit to do can come ask me. I can give you some ideas.
Thanks. Abraham?
Thank you for inviting me. We are at a crossroads, as James pointed out. I think the one thing, the one like piece of advice or like caution or something that I would leave the group with is kind of to be very aware of what the force that we're up against. Which I guess is the same thing you just said. But
I was actually talking about organizing ourselves is the hard part, not just the boss.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, so yeah, neoliberalism has been shown to kind of be this, you know, It doesn't work. It's got contradictions in and of itself. But it's also a beast that has, you know, changed forms so many times and kind of absorbed the work that we've done and turned it into, you know, shit so often. We need to be smart. We need to be united. We don't always do either of those things, right? Many times we don't. We're neither united nor smart about how we go about it. And I think if we're gonna step up to this challenge, we need to be really kind of clear our heads and be clear about who our friends are. And maybe not. Maybe that's the wrong thing to say. Maybe we should be clear about who our enemies are, and unite. I think that's a lesson the Republic workers say every time if you hear a Republic worker speaking, like that's the thing they talk about, right? Is how they came together when the need was there. They came together. They crossed all sorts of internal disputes to shore united front. They built the union had built coalitions with community groups like JWJ and so on and so forth, and with other unions, and then the people came, right? Like, and then all those politicians wanted to be part of that fight and were actually on our side. But the lesson they tell all the time is about unity. And then of course strategy is kind of embedded in that as well.
Thank you. Everybody, I'm really grateful for the four of you to have come out tonight. I forgot to make my announcement at the beginning. Platypus is putting its first ever international convention, and kind of like the subtitle is What Has the Left Been and What Can It Become? I really hope that those of you who are in Chicago will come and join us here at the School of the Arts of Chicago. We'll have 2 days of panels and discussions. We'll start on Friday night and go all the way to Sunday. So, yeah, hope to see you all here. Good night, everybody.